kind of thing. What was interesting to me was that he had lived a real life. He had lost terrible things. He had lost his, as we all know, he had lost his wife and his daughter. He had bombed out of the presidency for plagiarism in 1987. Didn't even make it to 88. We sometimes say the 88 race, but he was out even before then. He then had two aneurysms right afterwards. They said, you might not ever speak again. That's what the doctors told him. He was read his last. And by the way, when they told him that, it was after the plagiarism scandal, and he said, you know, that could have helped me, actually, a few months ago. So all of this stuff had happened. And the reason why it was interesting to me is Washington is a place where usually people have led lives. The reason they got there is because they had the Rhodes Scholarship, and then they cruised into Washington and started measuring the drapes. So they haven't lived all that much life. Joe Biden, he had a sort of silver medalist's mindset. Like, he was constantly aggrieved. He had a chip on his shoulder, and that was this engine that powered him. And eventually, through the strangest turn of events, you know, in 2016, of course, he didn't really get the nod from Obama. Obama supported Hillary. And at that point, Biden had lost his son, Beau, a kind of one more piece in this puzzle of loss. And when he ran in 2020, it was almost like his life was this strange, perfect opposite of Donald Trump's life. You know, Donald Trump had started life with, as you'll recall, as he said, a small loan of $100 million from his father, and words to that effect, and had led this life of gilded opportunity and had declared bankruptcy over and over again. All that's to say, and Biden, just by being a decent guy, was in his own way kind of an alternative. Already in 2020, there was concern about his age. It was clear at that point he would be the oldest president we'd ever had. And he said, he made, and we all remember this, he made a promise, in effect. He said, I will be a bridge. I'll be a transition candidate. And, you know, he tried to kind of weasel out of it a little bit. People would say, are you saying you're only going to run for one term? And he'd say, no, I'm not saying that, but I'll be a bridge. And everybody interpreted it for what he was hoping they would take him to mean. And I think, in a way, what happened in that story is that he lost sight of that promise, and he broke that promise to Americans on a level that offended them more than he understood. You know, he thought, well, they're going to reward me for my performance. They're not going to want to usher me out, particularly when the alternative is this guy who I drove out of the White House. And he didn't understand that his very presence, he himself, aging so visibly and in violation of the compact that he had made with the public, became essentially ineligible for the presidency. And he never grasped it. And the more that the data, the more that the evidence became clear that he would not win, the more he dug in, and that old chip on his shoulder became a diabolical problem and became, in a way, a blinding effect. And he and his people around him blinded themselves to the reality of what they were facing.
You're listening to WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee, WMDX Columbus, Madison, WCFW HD2, W228 EP Chippewa Falls, WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, WLAK Amory, and WLCX La Crosse. A part of the Civic Media Radio Network.
We saw him every day on TV. He had this very clotted voice. He was kind of weakening. That was quite obvious. We all saw that. I remember mentioning in the article that he had these cards that he was using. And it was, you know, it was prompting him. It was not particularly strange. He was using it to reel off quotes from Trump that Trump had said, odious things and so on. But what struck me most of all, David, was that he was defiant. He was completely defiant. No matter how many times I asked the question of, but what about the fact that people expected you to run? Or asked the question of, but what about the fact that the polls show today that you are trailing in a way that you never were in 2020? His answer was always the same, which is, I'm the only one who's beaten him. And he'd become convinced that there was something special about his moment. I think January 6th had a transformative effect on his imagination of the presidency. That watching this assault, not only on democracy, but on the building where he really felt at home in his life. Right. He was always a creature of the Senate. That he felt by the time he got there, 14 days later, you know, literally 2 weeks standing on those steps, that he felt as if it was almost like a calling. And it was a tragic and really a calamitous misunderstanding of his mandate, of what the country asked of him and what the country wanted of him. And what saddens me as a person who found so much decency and humanity in his life before that was that he marred his legacy, he marred his record by staying too long and making that catastrophic decision to run and to stay after the world was telling him the time has passed.
That turned into a sort of a tragedy.
Absolutely, a tragedy.
It is
a tragedy, and it is like so much in his life. It is it's been a life of improbable success and almost incomprehensible staggering losses, and some that fate visited upon him and some that he created himself. He's, you know, I think that over time, as we have with some other one-term presidents like George H.W. Bush or Jimmy Carter, where we will look back on the things they did and begin to say that maybe they were laying in elements of our future that weren't recognized at the time. That's certainly the case with Biden's infrastructure investments, drug prices, climate to the degree it hasn't been unwound under Trump. But that can't compensate for, it doesn't erase what was, in the end, a violation of what he set out to do, which was to save us from a second Trump term. And that anybody who pays attention to politics and pays attention to the mind and the psychology, as you have, of politicians, has to find that fascinating.
So I know that I'm asking you to mind read, but does he understand that now, do you think, or do you think he's rationalizing it today?
I don't think he understands that. I'm not sure he'll ever come to terms with it. I think that he became... Look, the presidency is a bizarre thing to want. And you've written about this. At the core of when you write about presidents, the question we're always trying to ask is, what makes this person get up out of bed in the morning and think, not only I can be, but I should be the president?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that is, if it wasn't slightly glamorous, it would be pathological.
I think it still is.
I think it may be both in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And in Joe Biden's case, you know, he had... The guiding mantra of his life had been that when the world pushes against you, that you push back harder and you are a walking icon of resilience. The problem is that there are moments when the right answer, the answer for yourself, for your legacy, and for the country, God knows, is to say, actually, I've run my race and it's over.
Yeah.
And he missed that cue. In a way, he almost became, I'm afraid to say, he became persuaded of a simplified mythology of his own life that wasn't as complex and real as the actuality was.
Since I want all these people to go out and buy your latest book, I will go back to that for one more story, which is the Florida story. I don't know if this is a crowd that might not even know who Florida is.
Oh,
but
yeah. I will say this one will stay with me forever.
Yes.
I wanted to write about the phenomenon as part of the Haves and Have-Yots books. As part of that book, I wanted to write about the phenomenon of pop stars doing private gigs for people at home. Because it used to be if you were the wealthiest guy in town, you would buy front row seats at the arena, or maybe you would get then later you'd get a skybox. And now, as a drummer said to me when I was interviewing about this experience, he said, you know, it used to be that nobody could afford to have the Foo Fighters in their backyard on a Thursday, but now you can. And so I faced this reporting puzzle, which is nobody wanted to talk about it. The artists didn't want to talk about it because it was kind of embarrassing to be doing these money gigs. The clients didn't want to talk about it because they didn't want to showcase how much they were spending. So I started calling artist after artist, and I was getting a whole lot of no's. And then I was talking to an agent. He said, I think there's somebody who might say yes. He said, do you know Flo Rida? And Flo Rida, not the target audience, I think. Flo Rida, I'll tell his people that this may not be the hall for him, but Flo Rida is a hip-hop star from the state of Florida, sings about, you know, apple-bottom jeans and the boots with the fur. Some of the younger people here will know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So I called up Flo Rida, who does a lot of these events, and I said, you know, could I report on this? Could I come along? And he said, yeah. Why don't you come along? And so I ended up embedding with Flo Rida for a bar mitzvah in Chicago. And I tell the story in the book,
not
but I can just
like
tell
you, Iraq, but
it was embedment, you know, it was, but it really was. I really did come home and I called my wife and I just said, I think I can die happy as a journalist. I've done all I can ever want to do.
So I'd like to close with honoring our fathers. You know, I do this event because
Absolutely.
Of my dad and the Cap Times. And I know you came up in a journalism family as well. Tell me about the lessons you learned from Peter Osnos and your family.
I guess what I learned from my dear dad is that we live in this place, this country, that has this tradition of a free press, which is an astonishing right. I grew up with the idea that being a reporter is just about the greatest job you can have in the world, because it is a passport to go anywhere. You can find yourself sitting on that ridiculous terrace in Monaco, or you can find yourself trying to blend in with Flo Rida's entourage in Chicago. Or, frankly, at moments of much greater significance, you can find yourself sitting across from a president in the Oval Office asking yourself, is he making a catastrophic choice, and what will happen to this country? It feels often, I think, like a tremendous weight, because you say to yourself, my God, I've got to get this right. But having lived in places where people don't have the luxury, they don't have the chance in China or in places like Iraq to go out and ask people in positions of power and privilege to explain themselves, it feels to me like the greatest gift, and I'm just grateful to have the chance to do it every day.
And by God, you do get it right. Thank you, Evan, so much.
Thank you, David.
You're listening to Civic Media's coverage of the Cap Times 2025 Idea Fest. We'll be back with more right after this.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
I didn't know what the hell Malort was, so here now, our own Carol, head of traffic, she's brought in Malort. Down the hatch, cheers to Malort. Now, it went down fairly smooth, but the back end is ridiculously terrible. Judas Priest, that's terrible. Once is enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like my time with women.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. When not trying to push her bathwater soap on lonely men or selling her good jeans, Sid Sweeney does a little acting. The Sidster will play a boxer in the upcoming film Christy, based on the real life of boxer Christy Martin. Born in small town West Virginia, Christy Martin realized at a young age she was a good puncher and capitalized on that skill to become the best female boxer of the 90s. Despite not being released yet, the film has had a few eyes on it and is currently pulling a 61% on Rotten Tomatoes. Actor Joel Kinnaman is not a household name, but he has a solid fan base, and he seems perfect for a good crime story. So it's no surprise he is the choice to play the lead role in a new crime drama called Bishop. According to Deadline, Kinnaman plays Bishop Graves, a weathered, experienced detective who chases a killer preying on San Francisco's elite, only to find out that the crimes have a connection to his own father. The series is currently in development at Amazon MGM. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear.
Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
James Santel joining me. Donald Trump just flat out threatening Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
A lot of people apparently, Maggie, in high places in government engaging in mortgage fraud, including Adam Schiff and Letitia James, and now Commissioner Cook as well. The Federal Reserve is created independent of politics, preventing exactly this kind of thing from happening. This is the instability that causes economic crisis.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
And good evening, everyone, at the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, on a beautiful September evening. I'm Todd Allball, joined by producer-engineer Aaron Zommers at 16 minutes now past the hour of 7 o'clock as Civic Media's ongoing coverage of the Cap Times Idea Fest 2025 continues here. Just got done with a fascinating presentation and a discussion with Evan Osnos, the panelist there, along with David Marinus. Thank you very much, Zommers. Marinus there was the moderator. And I thought it was just a fascinating discussion, and we're going to continue here at the bottom of the hour or shortly thereafter with another discussion with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as the panelist, and John Nichols, the great John Nichols, Capital Times author and independent journalist himself, is going to be here. This is all coming to us just down the street on the other end of State Street at Shannon Hall at the University of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Memorial Union live, and they are setting things up here for Governor Tim Walz. And we're also going to take a few minutes to listen to some of the other Ideas Fest activities this week, which continues, and more of it continues over the weekend. We're going to preview that. But right now, I want to bring on via phone from Memorial Union Hall at the University of Wisconsin Madison campus, the site of this evening's speakers for Idea Fest 2025, the political editor for Civic Media and the founder of the Recombobulation Area, the one, the only, Dan Schaefer. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Todd.
It's always a pleasure. Were you in the room for part of the Evan Osnos presentation?
I sure was, and I thought it was a fascinating conversation. Touched on so much that we, you know, that we talk about all the time on your show and across the Civic Media Network and at the Recombobulation Area, talking about issues of inequality, talking about you know, the politics of the day, talking about Donald Trump. I thought that he had some fascinating insights into Joe Biden there right at the end of the discussion as well. And yeah, just a really compelling conversation. And glad we're able to carry it here on Civic Media.
I couldn't agree with you more that I know the title of the discussion was the have and the have yachts. Catchy title, by the way. Apparently as a
I do like a good pun.
All right.
I like a good pun.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought the best part of the entire evening in terms of his discussion was this insight as someone who had followed Joe Biden for many years and could offer that unique insight into Biden towards the end of his political career. And also just this traveling around as well. So I was glad it went off on a tangent, as we say around here.
Yeah, that's right. It was a good tangent, too. I think that's why the conversation format really was great for this type of event, instead of just having, you know, somebody to give up and deliver a, you know, keynote style speech or something like that. I think the conversation format really allowed for things to go in a variety of different directions. And, I don't know if that Joe Biden segment was really planned or anything like that. But he talked about, you know, coming back from working over in China for quite some time and then coming back to the United States in 2014 and having a really easy time getting an interview with the vice president. Right. And then a decade later, having another interview with Joe Biden when he was, you know, as he kind of characterized, as Asna characterized, breaking his promise in a lot of ways to run for a second term. You know, and the decisions that and kind of like all of the different machinations and influences that fuel those types of decisions. I thought it was just absolutely fascinating.
That's part of what IdeaFest Cap Times, IdeaFest 2025 is about, bringing folks here within Madison in different locations throughout the week. Different folks, different voices around the country. I think it's just a great idea. It continues tomorrow, by the way, here in Madison. Dane County Executive Melissa Agard and Madison Mayor Satcher Rhodes Conway will be talking with John Nichols about Madison in this political era. Also in the afternoon, in the afternoon as well, Ben Wickler, former Wisconsin Democratic Party chairman, is going to be giving a talk as well. The rise of Christian nationalism is going to be on the docket tomorrow, particularly pertinent, timely indeed, as Mike Lucas would say, given the events of the Charlie Kirk assassination. And Dan and I, you and I talked about it on our show earlier this afternoon. It appears as more information comes out that this alleged assassin against Charlie Kirk may have been radicalized by the right online and part of this thing they call the Groypers, which is the something that a lot of people, as you said earlier today, think of MAGA as being right. Well, it may disturb people to know there's even a more far right. So probably couldn't be a more timely discussion of the rise of Christian nationalism, Dan.
Yeah, it's an important conversation. It's one that I think is, you know, a little bit flying under the radar in certain ways. And I think it's good to have a forum to discuss these types of issues. And I think it'll be a good conversation. It sounds like, you know, the way that this has embedded itself in our politics and it's just kind of intersection of religion and politics in so many ways. I think, you know, now is certainly the right time to be having these types of conversations.
The star of the show in terms of IdeaFest tomorrow ends up back where you're at tonight in Shannon Hall at Memorial Union on campus. It's a one-on-one with Illinois Governor Democrat J.B. Pritzker. And now we're seeing again, ripped right out of the headlines of the day, that in part, Dan, it appears that part of Governor Pritzker's kind of standing up to Donald Trump and the Trump administration, trying to come into Chicago with more ICE agents and possibly, keyword possibly, National Guard. That has deterred Trump. As we hear now, he's moving his attention to Memphis, Tennessee. So be interesting to see what Governor Pritzker says on that tomorrow.
Yeah, and on a host of issues, you know, I think Pritzker has become a pretty prominent national figure. And, you know, we've got a great week of hearing from some Midwestern governors. Tony Evers obviously spoke the other night, Tim Walz speaking minutes away here, and J.B. Pritzker. So, we've got most of the NFC North covered here, don't we?
We absolutely do. Now, if only we get the different quarterbacks in. I mean, that'd be even better. You're listening to continuing civic media coverage of Cap Times IdeaFest 2025, live from the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus here in Madison. I'm joined by political editor for Civic Media, founder of the Recombobulation Area, Dan Schaefer, over the phone. Dan, speaking of sports, one of the cool things about IdeaFest, it's not just all politics. And Mike Lucas and Tom Oates, great sports reporters here in the Madison area, they have a podcast, Oates and Lucas, or Lucas and Oates, with the Cap Times. And I was there at their IdeaFest presentation earlier this week. I want to take a clip. They sat down and talked with former men's hockey coach, Badger hockey coach, Tony Granato. And it wasn't just sports. So I'm going to pick it up here in the program where they're talking to Coach Granato about something that has touched both Coach Granato and Mike Lucas, the subject that touches far too many people, and that's cancer.
Tony's involved in a project, a docu-series titled Fight for Life. Can you explain what path you've gone down with this?
Sure. You know, this started about a year and a half ago. I had three buddies that were... I don't want to say they were looking out for me. I was going through my chemo treatment. I was right here in Madison. And my buddy said, hey, you can't sit around just waiting for your next treatment. We need to keep you busy. We got to find something for you to do. And they're in the TV and the sports industry. And they said, how about, you know, you think of an idea. We'll put a studio down in your basement. You can break down plays. You can figure out, you know, how to put something that we can get out there so people can watch you describe the game of hockey in some way, shape, or form. And we just started throwing ideas at each other. And you know what it's like going through treatment, Luke. There's some really tough days. And there were days where I was looking for things to be inspired by and be motivated by. And fortunately for me, I had lots of people, including yourself, that would reach out to me regularly and kind of share the journey and what I was going through. And lots of those people had either dealt with cancer or different things in their lives, and they became inspiring to me. So we came up with this idea that if things are inspiring to me of hearing of other people's stories and their journeys of beating, whether it be cancer, whether it be life trauma, those were inspirational to me. And so we decided to break down Doug McLeod, who is professor at the university in the journalism school, was one of those friends. And he started to look into stories and started to bring them to me and said, you got to see this story about Clint Malarchuk. You got to see this story, you know, about Craig Cunningham. We went on and on, and we put together a list of hundreds of athletes that have gone through life traumas, whether it be cancer, whether it be serious injury, whether it be mental health struggles, whether it be addiction, and they've been able to get on the positive side of it and be role models for those that are dealing with their own situation. So we did a pilot with Clint Malarchuk. He was the goalie. If you guys remember Steve Tuttle, an old Badger, Steve Tuttle crashed into the net playing for the St. Louis Blues, and a skate came up accidentally and cut Clint Malarchuk's neck. And it got his jugular and probably should have bled out. Fortunately, there was a trainer that was on the bench that knew what to do because of his experiences that he had overseas at war. So he was able to slow the bleeding down enough that the doctors could clamp it. He lived. He's had multiple other issues that was associated with that injury, including PTSD. And so we did the pilot on him. He's doing great. He's a friend of mine. That pilot went on NHL Network month of July. We got a good start with that one. We got Eddie Olczyk, Craig Cunningham, two other spectacular stories that are being edited right now that'll hit the network on October 1st and November 1st. And we're planning on doing 8 episodes in season one. All will be in the game of hockey. And then once we get through season one, we're planning on expanding out to other sports and different ideas.
That's terrific. So right now it's on the NHL Network. Is that how people would access it?
It is. It'll be on YouTube soon. It'll be on our website soon. This all came about fast with NHL Network wanting it in July. We weren't quite up to date with everything we needed to be to have it be distributed in different ways. The most important thing for us is if there is somebody out there that needs to be inspired by a story, we want them to see it. So we're not trying to sell anything. It's a nonprofit. We're all doing this. All our four partners are doing it with the kindness of their heart to try to share a story that, you know what stories are, Luke. I don't have to tell you this. You know, when you find somebody that's beating something, it gives you a little bit extra. And our goal is to get it out, whether it be on YouTube, whether it be on our website, some sort of platform that if somebody needed it and somebody saw or heard about it, can give a friend a message, hey, you got to watch this. This is something that might help.
That is former Badger men's hockey coach Tony Granata talking to Mike Lucas and Tom Oates on their Capital Times podcast, Lucas and Oates, part of Idea Fest 2025 earlier this week. And bringing Dan Schaefer, our civic media political editor and founder of the Recombobulation Area, back in. Dan, I wanted to play that because I think it's a great example of what Idea Fest is. It could be as diverse as that, a Badger coach talking about his fight with cancer and using it for something positive, to what we're going to hear in just a minute, which is Governor Tim Walz.
Yeah, absolutely. A great range of topics and you know, just such a very Madison event here,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It really
and
is.
I think, and I'm excited to hear, you know, from Governor Walz. I don't know if he's made many, you know, public statements or anything like since the assassination that occurred this week. But, you know, given his experience on the campaign trail last year and dealing with, you know, potential threats or things like that, I'm interested to see if that, you know, comes up in this conversation and what he might have to say about that as well. And you know, it's I think it goes to the spirit of the larger festivals, just to sit down and have a conversation.
That conversation is straight ahead. Dan Schaefer, thank you very much. Tim Walls is next. Many thanks to Parker Olson, Dom Lee, and Mr. Aaron Zomers as well. Luke Mathers, for all of us, I'm Todd Alba, the Civic Media World Headquarters. Tim Walls and John Nichols, live from UW-Madison, is next across our network and across Wisconsin. It's coming up on 7:30, and you're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
I've been backstage, and this is going to be a lot of fun, this next session. You know, most of us here in Madison probably feel we've gotten to know Minnesota Governor Tim Walz pretty well over the past 15 months or so. And I just want to say we are ecstatic to have him at Idea Fest tonight. Before our marquee program, I do want to take a minute to thank our sponsors who really make this whole thing possible. Our major sponsors again this year are Epic, Exact Sciences, and UW Health, the Carbone Cancer Center. Thank you. We so appreciate them. Thank you. Our co-sponsors are Madison Gas and Electric, the University Research Park, the University of Wisconsin, Madison, the University, the Century House, the Penzi Spices, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, the Madison Community Foundation, Cargo Coffee, the Freedom from Religion Foundation, the Forward Theater Company, Leopold's Books Bar Cafe, and Madison College. Thank you. Thank you. Let's give them a hand. Our media partners are Hinckley Productions, Civic Media, Wisconsin Public Radio, the Wisconsin State Journal, and Madison.com. Hand for them as well. Thank you. Thanks to all of them. Backstage tonight, visiting with the governor. I'm already really charged up for this. So Timothy James Walz was born and grew up in a small Nebraska town. After high school, he worked in a factory and joined the Army National Guard. He later graduated from college and in 1996 moved to Minnesota, where he famously taught social studies and coached football. The future governor became involved in politics and was elected to Congress 5 times. He was elected governor in 2018, reelected in 2022, just as our own Tony Evers. Governor Walz, of course, became a prominent national figure last year when then Vice President Kamala Harris selected him as her running mate. He has continued to speak out effectively and with passion throughout the country against Donald Trump and Trumpism. His state has endured 2 horrific acts of gun violence this year, and he is pushing new gun laws there. We're talking, yes, indeed. We're talking how this week's shooting and the outrageousness of the reactions, of the contrasting reactions, only serves to highlight the issue again. Just a quick aside, the Minnesota governor's appearance continues our success at securing awesome speakers from our neighbor to the Northwest. In our first Idea Fest in 2017, we hosted Senator Amy Klobuchar. Two years ago, we hosted Attorney General Keith Ellison. John Nichols, associate editor of the Cap Times and tonight's moderator, says that the attorney general told people in Minnesota that the Twin Cities should have an event like this one. I kind of like that. Word apparently got around, and so when John contacted Governor Waltz's team, he was the first major commitment we had to this year's Idea Fest. And from my standpoint, that was really important. I think I can speak for everyone in this theater tonight to say we are deeply grateful to him and him for appearing in Madison tonight. Please give a warm welcome to Governor Tim Walz.
It looks like you're going to have to establish yourself with these people.
Well, I was saying that was incredibly kind. I said, I hope you feel the same way when we're done.
So, could go bad. Yeah, I know. It's you know, I just to put you at ease.
That felt loaded, didn't it?
Yeah. Just so you know, the county you're in voted 75% for you and Harris.
Highly educated people.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The city was up in the mid-80s for you and Harris.
Yeah.
And some of the precincts around here busted 90%. So just so you know, it was
good.
You might have wanted to share some of that out in other places, but...
We have to figure that out.
Yeah. Man. They liked you here. As we start out, I just want to make note, and the lights are down so we can't see it. And, you know, to be very honest with you, Idea Fest attracts an audience that includes many people who have experience in life. But I will tell you, having watched... What?
I'm seeing some pretty young folks.
Well, this
folks
is what I was going to say. I
experience.
Will tell you, having watched every Idea Fest this week and in the past, aside from Bernie Sanders, the person who has drawn the largest number of young people to an event is Governor Walz. And there's a whole crowd of UW students and other folks around here. You can't see them, but they're there.
I see them.
And I don't know what it is. What is it about Walz that appeals to the young?
Man, that's a good question. I got asked last week, they said, you poll much better amongst women than men. And I looked at my wife and she said, don't ask me. I don't know that one. I do think on this, I think it's the teaching. I think spending so many years in the classroom, and I would hope what they're getting that vibe is the genuine respect. Because I always said, when those of you who are teachers in this room, thank you for that. But I also... But, you know, when you're a brand new teacher and that first day you go in the classroom and you know everything, and then you come back on the second day and you know nothing, and you spend 20 years learning it, I learned very quickly on. I was certainly not the smartest person in that classroom. I was usually the most experienced, as you said, but it was life experiences. And I think it was that connection through teaching, which I think is what I was truly born for.
Yeah.
Probably and more so than being vice president. So
the American people gave you a cue on that one. But let me ask you about, this is interesting that you were backstage. Before we came on, you were meeting with a bunch of young folks who had staffed rallies and events that you had done. And it was a very interesting thing. You said to them, the first political rally I went to was when I was 41 years old.
Yeah. Remember the times when we had the luxury that you didn't have to be that engaged and the world didn't burn down around you, and you know, you wouldn't see the president for like 4 months and you're like, oh, I'm glad he's okay, and you know, you would just kind of move on. But look, I was teaching school, actively engaged in the National Guard, and I voted and I was engaged, but as a social studies teacher, I wasn't at events. I didn't do those, you know, wasn't actively political. And I think it's just life was coming at me. And I tell the story, I did a deployment with the National Guard, came back, and it was the 2004 election. And I was kind of a John Kerry guy. And I got back sometime that summer. And George Bush was coming to Mankato in August of that year. And I had some fellow teachers say, Tim, we're going to be out of town. Would you take these kids to see George Bush? And I'm like, yeah. And look, I didn't really care much for the guy. At that time, I thought, man, it'll never get worse than Bush. And now I'm like, yeah. Now we want to buy his paintings and crap. You know, I'm like, so. But I wasn't really active. And I don't think a lot of people knew, you know, obviously probably leaning pretty progressive, the things we did, that was clear. But anyway, I said, sure, I'll take them. We get to this rally. And these kids were politically active. They were young Dems, so they knew it. And one of them pulled out his billfold and had a John Kerry sticker on it. You had to have tickets to get in this thing. And the people at the event said, well, I'm sorry, you've been deemed a threat to the president. You're going to have to go back, because you had to drive a bus to the event and get back. And I said, oh, no, they're fine. They're with me. And they said, who are you? I said, oh, I'm their teacher. I'm Tim Walz. I'll vouch for them. They're all good. No problems on this. And they said, do you have a ticket? I said, yeah. And they said, well, you too have been deemed a threat to the president. And this was my first thing. And this is in my hometown. And people are walking by. I'm like, hey, Gary, you know, saying hi to friends and stuff. Politics wasn't quite that corrosive. But anyway, I said, no, it's fine. I said, that's not true. And then it started to get kind of serious. They said, well, you're going to get on the bus and leave, or you're going to be detained and, you know, taken out of here. And at this point in time, I'm like all puffed up. I'm like, well, you know, I'm in the military. I just got back. They didn't care.
And then to be a football coach. Well,
and then I gave them this one. I said, I'm the teacher of the year in Mankato. And they really didn't care. And then I said, okay, here's what's going to happen. Those kids are going to get on the bus, and I'm going to go in there, and then you're going to decide whether President Bush's speech is front page, or the local high school teacher and football coach, you know, National Guardsman, gets arrested for wanting to see the president. Well, if you behave, we'll take you there. You know, we'll do that. So they stood beside me. The kids went back and said, Mr. Walz got arrested. And she's like, damn it. You know, he can't do anything. And the whole neighborhood's blowing up or whatever, and I come home. But I'll tell you, the thing was, it was more feeling a sense of shame, like the privilege of not being engaged actively in politics because of this. And there I was, you know, saying, well, I'm this guy, I do this or whatever, in front of my neighbors, and I watched these people look right through me. And like, it didn't matter, and they didn't care. And I was just ashamed, you know, a little bit. I'm like, God dang, you know, we got to do something. So I got involved in John Kerry campaign. Long story, he loses. Somebody says, well, you should run for Congress. You did a good job with that. And I'm like, okay, I don't know, you know, no one, and I'm glad I didn't know it at the time, one Democrat since 1892 had won that district, and so I didn't realize I was the sucker that they were putting forward, so, but long story short, I got engaged to those young people, and people getting engaged and being there, I am just in awe of them, I'm inspired by them, that they know how it is, and that campaign, by the way, four of my former students, all four young women, super talented, one graduated from Marquette, one from University of Wisconsin, two from Minnesota, and those four women ran that campaign. And then when we started getting hot and it got into October and it looked like we were going to win, and I tell him this, Rahm Emanuel was running the DCCC, he said, all right, we're going to give you some money, but you got to get new staff. I said, keep your money, I'm keeping them. And he gave the money anyway. So Rahm gave the money. And they were... Look, we were five people who didn't really know what we were doing, but we were pretty passionate about it, and I see that with young people. So I think that's why, but I don't know. Maybe I graded easily. That's why they like me. So
that's a pretty good story, and I think the lesson of it is that if the Bush camp and the people around him had just been smart enough to let you in without a question, you'd still be teaching in Mankato.
Oh, this gets better. Like, I win, and the first quote I get in the paper was, the press is there, and they announced that I win that night. Remember that 2006 wave? I was the last ones getting washed up on the shore when all the Democrats won. And I looked to my wife, and I said, I don't even know what this job is. I had not been in the Capitol. I took a close-up trip to Washington with kids, but I had never been in the Capitol. And all of a sudden, there I was. So before they swear you in, they take you to the White House, and we go in there, and it's George Bush, who, by the way, he and Barbara were so gracious they have you in there. But Karl Rove is in there. And remember that? Again, remember, we thought he was the worst it could get. And So Rove walks up, and I was going to introduce him because I'm like all these people I'd seen on TV, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in the White House. This is so great. And I go over, and I said, Mr. Rove, he goes, I know who you are. He goes, I have one question. Where'd you find all the Norwegians to vote? And he knew that voting district to the number, and he said, you increased turnout by 3%, and that was probably enough to help you win. And, like, he knew all those things that were out there. And that one kind of blew me away that, one, he knew, and secondly, how it just seemed kind of like a game to him, you know, more so like he knew the numbers and didn't know it. So, yeah, and then he did say, yeah, it'd probably been easier just to let you in the event. And
there you go. So, Kyle Rove, a very good political analyst, has sussed your career out. So what you did there is part of why you've been so successful as a political figure. You're self-deprecating. You're witty, you're charming. But, and
I should have brought my wife. I knew that.
Yeah. But that's a part of it in politics. This is the nature of politics. But you also, they're told a story of a time in politics that now seems like ancient history. And that's, I find that jarring.
It's
people
jarring.
Ask me about this all the time. They'll say, you know, well, like, must love covering politics. I said, I did love covering politics for a long time. Now I feel it's more like a duty or a responsibility. It's a very different thing. Politics has become a much harder, crueler experience. And we'll talk about your political career a lot, but I think, you know, we should begin tonight after you've kind of framed us and give us perspective on where we were. This has been one of the most jarring several months in the history of American politics. And this week we had the horrific shooting of Charlie Kirk in Utah, and in all the play out of that. And it reminded us, of course, those of us who actually pay attention, and I know that's not always the case in media, but those of us who pay attention, that up in Minnesota, not very long before, you had a horrific political assassination, a pair of political assassinations by someone who had a list of legislators, and I think you were on the list, along with the Attorney General and lots of other folks, and many Wisconsin legislators as well. And so that's the dark side of where we're at right now, because we have come to a point where political violence is not something we can say is foreign. Obviously, it's never been foreign. We've had assassinations in the past. But now it seems to be coming at us in some unbelievably unsettling ways. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, as somebody who knew several of the people who were killed, to talk about this a little bit in this stark moment we're in.
No. Well, I appreciate you bringing it up. And look, it's still very visceral. And it is jarring. I heard someone on, I don't listen to NPR or something, Why We Still Can, listening to someone mentioned, and they said they were making the comparison that, look, we had President Kennedy's assassination, Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, you know, Medgar Evers. We had all these things happening, and they said, so, you know, how it felt. And this person was an older person who was engaged in politics, and they said, yes. And when those happened, they were horrific, but they felt horrific and not ordinary. What's different now is it feels more ordinary, and that's terrifying. That's what this person said. And I don't know, I'm too close to it and too much in that grieving and processing stage of the anger and all of this comes, because just to let all of you know, you know, the media moves on, every single individual, but just a singular force in Minnesota with Melissa Hortman. And I don't think outside there that we know, as I said, without a doubt, she'd have been a governor, and I think a really good one. And I think in Minnesota, we talk about her in the same breath as like a Mondale or Wellstone, and she had that type. She was the most talented. I said, there's two people I saw could run a House floor, who could manage a caucus, who could message, who could think policy, and who could actually get things done, and it was her and Nancy Pelosi. And that was an amazing thing. And she was my closest political ally. And
in a big part of your success.
Oh, without a doubt. We wouldn't have got it done. We had a one-vote majority, and I said that majority has led to free school breakfast, paid family medical leave, 24. Yeah. She understood that the politics was a means to an end, and we were tied at the hip to get it done and to get a call at 4 a.m. But what was more jarring about it is it was happening. This guy was on the steps. We're trying to get him. All that's happening in real time while we're trying to do that. And then to turn on the TV and see the President of the United States, like, just flippantly saying things to me, like, you know, he's a mess, he's doing this or whatever. And I'm like, how do you, something like this happen, and how does it become about you? Or how does it become about me? And just that, the thing that terrified me in this whole thing, and it still terrifies me, just the lack of basic humanity, regardless of the politics of it, is really there. So I, and then as it bleeds into, and then of course we had the Annunciation shooting last weekend, we had a celebration of life for an 8-year-old for Fletcher, and this Sunday we'll go with the parents and we'll have Harper's. That's what Minnesota's living through. And then this comes out this week, and you see the first thing is to go hard to blaming, to ginning more of this up. And I've said this, that I don't tend to overreact. I think high school teachers in here know you'd be dead if you overreacted all the time. You just kind of do your stuff. So it's not like it. But look, it's very raw. It's very open. But I am deeply concerned, deeply worried about this. And I've been saying it on the political side of things. And now it's entered this new phase. So I wish I had something profound to tell you. But it really is about people just being decent and recognizing it and saying it. And if you're not going to do that, it's very hard to fix it. I mean, that's the thing, this whole thing about how do you fix somebody else on this? If you're not gonna go to that space, I have a real hard time is how do we talk about it? How do we bring people back into this conversation in a way that is productive? And I don't have an answer to that. And I don't know if the country does right now.
I think the country is wrestling with it. I was struck by the Texas legislator and U.S. Senate candidate, James Tallarico, who is kind of rising up. And
yeah, I like that guy.
You like that guy.
I like it.
You know, well, and there's other candidates, and yeah. You know, but I was struck by his response to it because he is a devout Christian. And he, although I think if he was, as an individual, if he was Jewish or Hindu or whatever, he would have gone to a spiritual place. But he talked after the murder of Charlie Kirk and said, you know, we certainly had differences, without a doubt,
yeah.
Fundamental. And yet, he said, I'm taught that he is my brother and that that we are human beings of the same of the same blood, of the same traditions, or whatever. And it was this very, it was a very human and I think unexpected response, you know, that someone would go to that place, to go to a spiritual place. And I think, I was fascinated by it. I don't know
Well, he's a good person, because I'll be honest, that's not necessarily where I went immediately on some of this, because I'm serious, and I mean it just because I've said this, and I've been very candid. I've said it publicly, and I don't like it that it's true, but I said specifically, the president brings out the worst in me, and it makes my worst self. We used to have a saying, you lay with dogs, you get fleas type of thing, and I just feel it's even deeper than that, and it pushes me in a position like I'm trying to figure out, how do you push back and debate a policy position when it is so visceral, it's so personal, and it is so loathsome of how do you get there? So I find myself getting into a place where it goes against my nature. I know it's not as generous a space as I need to be in when I see this, and I'm trying to figure that out. Look, the outrage of this week, the family and everything that went on, and you can disagree with the policies, but it was the response from some people afterwards, the very people who couldn't even call the children of Melissa and couldn't even do that. I don't understand how you can separate that. I don't understand how you cannot see the children that lost a father this week and the children who lost a father and mother in June. How are those, how in your mind do you separate the humanity on that based on the politics? And yet there's a big chunk of the country is able to do that very easily. So no, I appreciate going there, and I think you're trying to find answers. I keep going back to it. I mean, I don't know how we respond as a nation on those types of things happening, and then children sitting in church on the first day of school and being shot, and then we're in this thing about, you know, the guns or whatever. It is the guns, I'm telling you, and let's have the discussion on it. And how do you get there? And then how do you have that debate? Because it just, it disintegrates into this, and, you know, then all of a sudden you're disrespectful on this. Like, I said, we need to get meaner in our politics, and they immediately say Governor Walz is adding to this climate, which may be a valid point, but I don't know how you push back on the cruelness that's out there without yourself being a little cruel. And it's a real dilemma, and I we're going to have to figure it out.
I just want to tell folks, you just saw a very rare thing in politics, which is a prominent political figure, former candidate for Vice President of the United States, saying, I'm wrestling with this, I don't know how to deal with it. And that is often in politics seen as weakness, to acknowledge, I don't have the perfect answer to every question. But I think that has been a part of your strength in politics. You came in late. You were born in a small town in Nebraska. You went into teaching. That was your career, and served in the National Guard. And you had a life. And you didn't come into politics until you were an adult. Some people would even say edging toward middle age. Yep. Although in our crowd tonight, we say we're still very young. So, but this is a significant thing. Do you think there is some chance that you came into politics having had enough of life,
yeah,
that you were willing to acknowledge sometimes that you didn't know all the answers?
Yeah, I think so, and I don't. This is a new phenomenon that has happened. I think, you know, I'm a big early adapter on the internet. We had a T1 line back in the early 90s. Some of the tech people in here know this, in western Nebraska, so that we could teach languages to those rural schools. And I taught myself HTML. I created a website, and I was like selling trips to Tibet on the internet. And I remember I sold 10 of them. I sold 10 of them as a teacher. I made $1,000 extra on each one, so I made $10,000. And I remember this is 1991, 92, and I told my wife, I said, I think there's money to be made on the internet. And then with my political acumen, I moved on. And but
just to be clear, you didn't invest.
But I think it was the idea of a set of life experiences that were very different, and I was shaped by it, that it wasn't through, I was a Democrat, but I didn't go to the Democrats. The Democrats came to me. It was just natural. It was Social Security survivor benefits for my family. It was the GI Bill. It was Pell Grants at college. And I, you know, becoming a young adult, I'm like, well, the Democrats seem to be the people who support us, and the Republicans support the businesses and the country clubs. Not even as a pejorative, it was just known to everybody. And I think I kind of lived my life like that, and, you know, grateful. I grew up Catholic, but some of you of a certain age, like me, the priest in our small community was a liberation theologist. And that was a very interesting, yeah, some of you know, that was a very interesting.
We should explain to some of the college students here that liberation theology actually.
Very grounded in the social activism of the church, very grounded in helping. A lot of these folks were active when, you know, in the 70s and 80s in Central America and others. It was especially coming out of the nuns who were there too, that they were very active. And we were strong, you know, Catholic church every week, Wednesday, CCD, you know, and then during certain times of the year, you had to go in the mornings, you know, and I, as a usual kid, my mom would drag me in there. I didn't know it in our family. We had had priests in the family and had people actively engaged, and they thought a priest would come out of my mom Darlene's family, and she always said she thought it would be me. How wrong could she have been? They went into, look where I ended up. But I just think it was that. And I am convinced of this. Like, we have this discussion about age in politics and about experience in politics. And I think all of you in different organizations you work for, I especially see it in school. The most successful schools, in my opinion, are the ones that have that wonderful mix of mid-career teachers who are just, you know, getting it done, know how to do it. Those are at the end of their career who are wonderful, beloved, but ready for the retirement checks. And which is true, because you do this job until you retire, you deserve the damn check. And then, like my wife and I, the young teachers who come in, we did everything. We coached everything. We built the set. My wife was doing, what were we doing? We were doing Of Mice and Men, and she's helping direct the play. I'm doing the set, so I have all my kids in there, you know, with drills, and we're fixing stuff. And she said, Mr. Walls, we are almost at showtime. I need a door on this. I need a screen door that slams when we go out and shoot the dog, and I need it there. No problem. Come back after the little break or whatever, and there's a screen door on there. And she's like, well, thank you for that. We go home, and it was my screen door up my house. And so, but we didn't have kids. We didn't have anything else. We didn't have anything else to do. So we just did it all. And those, I would argue the same thing is true in politics, that there's this idea that, you know, we force, you know, we want young people. We do want young people in politics. We want those voices. But we also need the folks who lived other lives and had different experiences. And we need folks who have been there. The older teachers would hold us together when we needed to. And I think in our politics, the ability to get more of a cross-section. But look, all of us know why there's not a lot of young people in politics, because it's, you know, gerrymandered districting and money in politics that makes it impossible. The idea of a teacher with no political experience, no name recognition, and I know I repeat myself because I said I was a teacher, no money and no connections to win a congressional seat is a testament to Minnesota, to be honest, that the party is there, that you could still do it. But, and when I got there, everybody has that story. You know, everybody's Mr. Smith goes to Washington, except their parents were federal judges.